give that shit up, you can concentrate on golf.
If you can dodge a wrench, you can dodge a ball.
Great moments are born from great opportunity.
You play ball like a girl!
Hi everybody, and welcome to a Roy Orbison Tattoo Podcast with me, Colm, and my co-hosts Massey and Paul. This is episode 1 of season 2. If it is your first time listening, I would advise to go back to the start and listen from episode 1, as we will refer to previous shows from time to time. This show does contain film spoilers, so if you have not yet seen the film, I would advise watching it first. It might help you understand a little bit better. And now for today's show, I hope you enjoy. Today, we are looking at Mike Bassett, England manager, and I'm delighted of Shane Keegan, former manager of Galway United and Wexford Utes, amongst many other roles, and current host of the very successful podcast, How to Win at Domino's, with us to chat about this. And I suppose, Shane, it's Mike Bassett is part of your podcast, really, isn't he?
Yeah. The intro music, obviously, those who like the film will probably have copped it from early on. I thought it was a good choice. It was actually the lads in the studio in the 42 who picked that, not me directly. I don't know if any of you have seen the Kerr's Kids documentary on Brian Kerr. Kevin Brannigan over in the 42 did it. A fantastic documentary. But Kevin is my producer, basically, for the podcast. So I think it was himself and a couple of the fellas, so a couple of the hipsters in the 42.ie who came up with it. But it's quite clever and quite apt for the theme of the podcast, I suppose.
Very good. And it's an old Brian Clough comment, is it?
Yeah, exactly. And again, to be honest with you, that had to be explained to me. I wasn't aware of that, so you're a step ahead of me. So you are. But Niall, look, again, as I say, they're fun guys over there, and they like to be creative with stuff. And, you know, I'm a very logical thinker. My creativity is on a score of 0 now, to be honest with you. I was coming up with coaching corner and coaching this and coaching that. I knew it was never going to cut the mustard for the kind of stuff the boys like. So I says, here, look, you just come back to me and tell me what you want to call it. So, yes, they had to explain the whole significance of the quote to me, so they had, Colm.
It's actually apt as well that, you use Mike Bassett. Like, there's an awful lot of allusions to Brian Clough. Well, there's Brian Clough a small bit, but English managers, soccer managers, and I suppose between Mike Bassett, who would stereotype would be Sam Allardyce, looking like even the backroom team and everything, there's allusions to different sets of management and players that have been involved in the England team. So an interesting start for it, I suppose, and that's probably a lot to do with it. So what do you think of the film yourself?
Ah, look, it's a great laugh, isn't it? It really, really is. I think what made it obviously probably was the casting. Like, it's hard to imagine anybody else really in the world that could have played Mike Bassett. I mean, if ever a role was created for a particular person, I think it was absolutely bang on. And look, some of the other castings were really, really good in it as well. You know, I don't know about yourselves, but I was a Dream Team fan back when it was on, back on Sky in the era. Yeah. So to see Carl Fletcher. was gas as well. So it was. But no, look, it's very, very funny, in fairness to them, from start to finish. And, you know, the poor man isn't getting a break anywhere. Not that he probably deserves a break right throughout it, to be honest with you. But becomes an absolute hero towards the end of it. If only all managerial careers actually did run according to the film, it would be great.
Yeah, it'd be all right. And Paul Massey, enjoyed it.
It's some very funny parts and one-liners, and it was a bit like The Office in parts, wasn't it? Just the fly in the wall type thing. But it was good to look back at it again. It was interesting. Some very funny parts of it, but it was just mad again. Like, it's just like we're picking just these mad films, it's great.
You know, I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it because it's obviously a comedy, but there's nothing until the last couple of minutes of it that's absurd that you couldn't actually imagine happening. Like, it was only the do a Maradona thing at the end where I thought it got absurd, but until then I thought, yeah, I've either seen that or I can imagine it happen, you know. So that's what made it really real. And I think they actually went into a fair bit of depth to make sure that it was realistic, that it wasn't like we're all in sport, we all enjoyed it, because there are similarities with what actually happens there. Like,
there's similarities to a lot from the very start, like even just how we ended up with the job. Like, it's like you come across plenty of clubs and managers who end up getting a job because nobody else wants it. And that was like, right how he got that job from the start. It was just ridiculous. Like, it was brilliant.
Actually, the football scenes in it are poor. The football, like, it's very Father Ted-like.
There aren't finely tuned athletes. Like,
all the characters, all the kind of main characters, they kind of based them off somebody. Like, you know, there was...
Gaza.
Gaza's one, Beckham. David Seaman with the ponytail.
Yeah.
I think Rufus Smalls was based slightly on Emil Heskey. Just he was always playing. Remember, he was scoring hardly any goals for England, but he was still starting every time up front.
Yeah, you might be on the ball there, yeah.
And then I'd say Wackett was just a mixture of every...
JT,
he was a thug, just, yeah. He was
John Terry.
Finney Jones. Terry
Butcher, plenty of candidates.
Yeah,
roll them all.
Julian Dix.
Yeah.
Julian Dix is right, yeah, they're all there, yeah.
But look, he was a self-proclaimed old-fashioned manager, and, you know, he kind of stuck with that in that he was... Like, as the film went down, it was 4-4-2, 4-4-2. And he changed it at once to, what did he call it? He called it upside down Christmas tree formation. Did he go 3-5-1-1, I think, or something like that? And he not only confused himself, but I think he confused the players. How important is it that, like, as a coach, that you're, I suppose, you stick to your own philosophy in a way? Now, obviously, you're taking on feedback from others, Shane. Like, you know, like, you obviously have a backroom staff, and you're you know, I'd imagine the players have a large input into stuff. But he was adamant, 4-4-2, that's my philosophy, that's what I want to do. And, you know, he went back to it at the very end, and that's what got him the success. How, like, when things are going wrong, how much influence comes from outside to alter it versus what you kind of feel is right? Maybe it's just not clicking?
Yeah, well, I think first you have to go back to the start. When you land into a place, what angle are you taking when you go in there? Are you coming in with a set philosophy and a set formation, and the players have to learn to play in that way? I mean, there are plenty of managers who go that route, and then you've got others who will land in and they'll see what they've got at their disposal, and they'll have a look and see what system they think will best suit what they've got. You know, there are two different approaches, and it's not to say that one is right and one is wrong. We would have done a lot on it. The word, I suppose, philosophy, and what does philosophy mean? I went back to college a couple of years ago in UCD. They had a fantastic master's course in sports coaching and science. And Shay Kelly, I don't know if any of you come across Dr. Shay Kelly. He's a cracking fella. So he took the coaching philosophy module, and it was brilliant. It was absolutely brilliant stuff. He'd challenge you on all that kind of stuff. You know, where's your philosophy come from? How married to your philosophy are you? Is there a point in even having a philosophy? And, you know, it got you thinking about stuff like that you wouldn't normally think about, because I maybe was a little bit airy-fairy on the idea of a philosophy. You know, I would be a bit more pragmatic and a bit more kind of, look, let's do what needs to be done here. I wouldn't be overly married. Yeah, it's if we have the players to do it, let's try and play out from the back. But, well, if we don't, let's come up with a different playing style that suits our players. And I suppose, look, one of the best, I've read an awful lot of biographies. The one that possibly clicked the most with me was Carlo Ancelotti's, because Carlo Ancelotti had a fantastic book called Quiet Leadership. And he, just in terms of how he went about things, you know, very much a go in, let's see what we have, and let's find a system that suits the players. Let's find a system that the players like, and kind of work from that way. That would be probably more similar to my approach to it, rather than, obviously, you have kind of the likes of your Pep, who either, you know, you fit the way I play, or you're not going to make the team. Mm-hmm. But as I say, it's not to say that there's a right way and a wrong way. Everybody has a different way of going about it, don't they?
Yeah. And what about Paul Massey? Like, obviously, being involved at levels, you're involved with colleges and intercounty and stuff. Like, you know me, I'm a romantic. I'd love to see the free-flowing game of passing the ball and scores, high-scoring games. But, like, sometimes that just doesn't cut it. Like, how would you feel? Is it something that you'd bring from team to team, or something that you kind of, again, would pick based on the players available?
I think for me, you have your own principles about what you want to do, but you might have to build around it, if you get me. Like, each team is different. Like, as you said, there is no point going into a team. For me, and I was going into a team and said, we're doing it this way and this way. But you don't have the players to adapt to that. That way is probably useless. So you have to come up, for me anyways, is to come up with what best suits the team, what best suits the players, and what way best suits you to coach that and bring it in. But you have, like, I have a certain philosophy, the way I want to play football or Gaelic football or whatever sport, and best trying to incorporate that, but with the players you have. But it's not all as practical. Like, it's It's like, you know, like I was training the team there tonight and Everton is perfect, going very well. Count the semi-final coming up. But I couldn't do that with another team, if you get me, the exact same way that I want to be playing. Like, so it's what suits the team, basically, for me. It's my York.
Paul?
Yeah, do you know what? I wouldn't have a philosophy specifically on playing styles that I'd bring from team to team. It would be very much based on the players that are available. I would have a philosophy, though, around behaviours and attitudes of a particular team, that whatever the team I'm involved with, that would be a mainstay. But on the playing style of things, no, I wouldn't. And just actually to Shane mentioned Seamus Kelly there. And Seamus Kelly, for people who are interested in the philosophy part of things and just, I suppose, different ways of thinking, his podcast with the Coaching Bubble is actually is one of their better podcasts. It'd be one of their top three.
It's a big call.
It's up there. It's up there.
It's a big call.
Alongside mine and who else's calls?
my one that's coming, is it?
Sean Boylan.
But Shane, you spoke about about players there and finding something that suits them as well. Like, I know that there was a team that I'd be vaguely familiar with would have had a change of management over the recent past or past season. And I suppose they would have had a very empowering manager before it, in that he'd be very much of the players' opinions on things as tactics and how we set up against this opposition and stuff like that. And a new management team came in with a more set, this is how we're playing, and did negative results fairly quickly. And there was a change of management mid-season, and they kind of went back to the old management, but the old style of management. But how important is it to empower players for these kind of things, that, you know, they feel a part of the decision making? Like, is it very important, or is it something depends again on the players that you have?
Yeah, look, it's a fine line, isn't it? You know, there's a fine line between you get players input and you win a couple of games and you've empowered them. You get players input and you lose a couple of games and you've shown weakness and you've shown a lack of decisiveness and a lack of leadership. You know, it really, really is a fine line, and the narrative will be dictated by the results that come with it. Look, I think younger coaches, younger managers are probably more into the empowerment side of things. But again, it's not to say that one way is right and one way is wrong. I think generational gaps will see a bit of a difference. Like, you take it, just obviously Mossy there being Galway, so right, you take it, I was at Galway and I would have absolutely bought into, had given the players a huge amount of say, arguably some would say too much say, right? But I just felt we had some fantastic characters in there who you could really trust their opinion. I had a phenomenal captain in Colm Horgan, Ronan Murray, David Cawley, a couple of fellas who I knew when I asked them a question, they would answer in the best interest of the team rather than in the best interest of themselves. So I felt you could do that. The following season, you know, I would have prided myself, certainly my 5 years at Wexford and in the first year at Galway, I would have prided myself on getting my recruitment right, which meant having the right kind of dressing room. In my second season at Galway, I got it completely wrong. I got it absolutely completely wrong. I got the makeup of my dressing room completely wrong. And yet I still continued to try that empowerment style of management. And now I was seeking the opinions of people who, in hindsight, were only ever going to give me the answer based on their own interests, probably is the way that I'd look at it, you know. So again, you have to adapt your approach. You can only take an empowerment approach if you feel that the players that you're asking their opinion for are going to give you opinions based on what's in the best interest of the team and not what's in the best interest of the player, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So you really have to know your player then, who you have to ask that. Like, we mentioned that a couple of times in the last few weeks, is that you really need to get to know the character of the person you're dealing with to do that sort of thing.
You do, 100%, absolutely 100%. And as I say, look, that comes down to your recruitment in the first place. Now, it's different, obviously, the difference between soccer and hurling or Gaelic football is that theory, budgets tend to hamstring you a hell of a lot, but in theory, you can pick and choose and go and bring in the kind of people that you want into your dressing room. Whereas, you know, that's certainly not the case in a club GA dressing room, even in an intercounty GA dressing room, right? You might exclude certain people from a panel if you think they're not the right kind of personality. But you know, if he's a really talented fella, you're probably going to have to include him and just find some way to work with him. So, look, I made a rod for my own back in that second season with Galway, but certainly it's a harder thing to do, in my opinion, in GAA circles, because you've got what you've got and you've just got to try and figure out who are the ones that you can trust and who are the right opinion, what are the right opinion, which people are the right opinions to seek, if that makes sense again.
And then it's sort of just, this is sort of expanding out on philosophies and stuff. It's like, I think like football and soccer, they're way ahead of a lot of GAA teams in terms of like the new League of Ireland under 13 teams, 15, 17s, whatever it is. A lot of teams are going with the same systems all the way up now. So like you're playing football, like you're trying to coach under 13s, that they're doing the same as what the adult team, the senior team is doing, is that when they do step up the levels, they're doing the exact same thing. But I think in GAA teams, a lot of us take the short term approach, is that the senior team could be doing something completely different to what the under 14s or 16s doing, and what their type of football or type of style of hurling is. I know a couple of clubs like Cross McGlen tried to do the exact same thing up from 12s, 14s, 16s, minors all the way up. Nemo to a certain extent as well, and Curfin, probably the best example. So when young juvenile players do step up that, they know exactly what they're doing.
But is that due to success and professionalism a small bit, like as in the clubs you've mentioned there? Like they're all successful, you know. If Billy Morgan is down in Nemo now saying to me, if I started, let's say my kids started playing there in 10 years' time, this is how we play football. Can't really argue with the man, you know. And from a soccer club, like I know it was something that like I know just from an Arsenal perspective and reading about Finger and stuff, that they would have done it before. And I'd imagine all professional clubs are doing it of the same, we're playing the same style. But is that because the person looking after the under 13 team, like it's a high profile position, obviously being involved with a team playing FA or playing the League of Ireland, as opposed to the local muckers down the back, you know, and that they have to fall into line?
I'd have to say it's hit and miss at League of Ireland level two now, I can certainly tell you. So it is. There are some clubs who, yeah, very much would be aligned from underage the whole way through. But if I had to pick the best example I've ever come across of a philosophy through an underage setup in true to the senior team, you've actually hit the nail on the head, Mossy. The best I've seen is Cora Finn. You know, I was lucky enough to spend 4 weeks in with Cora Finn last year during the summer with Debbie Morris and Kevin and that. And one of the days I took a session for them was on a bank holiday Monday. So I said I'd get up there early. I got up there. I was up there very early. I was up there maybe 2 or 3 hours before the session was on. But it was now everything was going well for them. The sun was in the sky. You know, it was an absolutely fantastic bank holiday Monday and the whole lot. But I got to bounce around between maybe about 4 or 5 different sessions from, I'm talking under 9 right through to their minors, all before going onto the pitch and working with their seniors. And I mean, you talk about synergy and a pathway. Like you could literally see, you know, maybe the same skill being worked at under 9 level, again at under 15 level, same skill, but progressed on 3 or 4 steps up the ladder. And the fact that to a man, almost, or to a child, I should say, almost every person that I came across was smiling. You know, that nearly is your philosophy, nearly more so than what was worked on. So, look, I wouldn't necessarily say that there's a huge, huge gap. I mean, in fairness to them, at League of Ireland level, you know, Shamrock Rovers seem to have an absolutely fantastic thing going on there at underage level. Bohemians, I mean, they've just played tonight and they've thrown in 1 or 2 kids because it's a cup game. They've made 1 or 2 changes and their kids the kids have come in seamlessly into the team and they've won. Again, I watched Bohemians 17s play against Dundalk 17s on Saturday, and again Bohemian 17s, they were just absolutely fantastic. So I would say Bose and Rovers seem to be the two League of Ireland wise who really seem to have it off to a tee. But I think there are certainly some fantastic GAA examples of it as well. I know Kildangan is another one that I've been kind of impressed with what they're doing over there. So I don't think there's a huge gap between what's happening in the different sports. Some good examples at some places, some bad examples at some places.
Good stuff.
Yeah. And just on that then, like, I know just we're talking about having the, I suppose, listening to people you're listening to and the people that are feeding, giving you information and feeding advice. We've seen the film there now with his backroom staff of Dodsey, who was your classic yes man. And I think we all know some managers that have a yes man with them, and Lonnie, the used car salesman, and a backroom team. The importance of that can't be understated as well, I'd imagine.
colossal. It's absolutely colossal. And I suppose the best way I'd look at it is, so I'm back in a role at the moment with Dundalk in the League of Ireland first team. But to be honest with you, kind of the week before the opportunity to come into Dundalk had come up, it looked like I was just about to take the reins with their intermediate. When I say senior, I mean adult hurling team in Kilkenny, which would have been my first step into kind of GAA circles at the highest level. And it had got as far as me putting together my management team for that role. And the reason I was so excited about taking on the role was because I felt I had managed to do exactly what I think should be done. And that's not always possible, because it can be very hard to find the right people. But what I was trying to do was, I was trying to find me plus two others. So between the three of us, I wanted three people with very, very different skill sets, but extremely similar mindsets, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So I was looking at me as having a managerial skill set. I was looking at another guy that I'd been talking to who was going to come on board with me. I thought he was a fantastic coach. He had a fantastic skill set in that area. And then another guy had a fantastic skill set in the area of physical conditioning. And then on top of that, I felt that while my strongest skill set was in management, I could maybe dip in and out of coaching. I could dip in and out of S&C. And I also felt the other two were capable of doing that. And then the fact that all three of us wanted to see the game played in the same way and had the same idea of how we were going to go about it in terms of style and shape and all of that kind of thing, and communication styles to players and, you know, standards of behavior and all of that, I was thinking, Eureka, this is what you're after. But that was probably trial and error. I'd probably picked that up from initially in a couple of jobs, probably bringing in fellas who were similar skill sets to me, which is definitely not the right way to go about it, you know. Mm.
And Paul, in your role as well, Paul, you'd be doing an awful lot of putting together backroom teams as well. Like, what kind of personalities or what kind of types would it be similar?
Yeah, like, looking at it from my perspective, I would be the opinion that we'd say arranged marriages don't work, you know, and that trying to fit people in together because they might have the same end goal in mind, very different ways of getting there, like, that doesn't work. And I think the idea of really taking your time and getting the management team right together is really important. And I think if the manager comes in, the manager has to have full responsibility for picking who he's to work with to make sure that it's going to work. And like Shane, you talked about having different abilities but the same mindset. I think also it could work having one person with a different mindset as well, to challenge you, just so that, like, I think it's important that in a management team that you can talk and have a bit of crack on a social level, just so that there's a good harmony there between you. But also, you need to be able to go, well, when we're down to business, you can't have your Bradley Walsh character who's just the yes man. You know, it's critical, and I don't think there's enough time kind of focused into it often enough, you know. And we often make whimsical decisions based on, do you know what, I had a point with him before and he talked a little bit of sense about hurling or football or soccer or whatever it is, do you know, I'm going to get him into a management team. And then 2 weeks later, he has fellas playing shorts versus skins in a match, you know.
The one I've never been able to wrap my head around, Paul, to be honest with you, from coming from primarily a soccer background and looking and having a big interest in GAA, the one I've never been able to wrap my head around is just the concept of selectors. Like, what are selectors? Like, what? I don't get this. Like, there seem to be fellas who, you know, they're maybe late 50s, early 60s, turn up to every training session, stand on the sideline, smoking a cigarette. They serve almost no real purpose. I can't, you know.
It's a very stereotypical view you got there, no shit.
it is changing. It is definitely changing. I'm just saying, I have no time for that person. That role makes no sense to me. Surely everybody who's involved in the management team has got to have a set duties, set roles. You know, okay, their set role might be that they handle the administration side of things. They don't have to be a genius on the call. I'm not saying everybody's got to be a coach, but they have to serve a role. Everybody has to serve a role. There's no point somebody just being along for the ride and to be mentioned in the speech at the end when you're lifting the cup.
I'd say with a lot of clubs, I'd say the role could be something very insignificant, but very significant. Like, the role could be a selector is the fellow who's in charge of the pitch, and whether you get to pitch on a wet February night under lights or not might be, but it might, you know, and it could be something as simple as that, or it could be the fellow who's, and like you said, no, the fellow, the traditional fellow in the 50 or 60s who probably is nothing else bar that, but he might be the fellow that has the gear there every night. He picks up the drawers, picks up the jumpers that are left behind. And for a lot of clubs, it can be something as menial as that a lot of time. But I know what you're like. I know, like, this tradition that GAA had before of appointing a manager, and see, the county board appointing selectors as well, who are completely different. But, you know, I think we're slowly getting away from it.
Even you talk about that. You talk about that guy you've just described there, right? Yeah. Like he's worth $1 million to you. And he needs to feel. He needs to feel important, and he needs to feel special, and the manager needs to know that, needs to make him know that he is really, really appreciated. But he should not have any input in team selection, tactics, any of that kind of stuff, in my opinion. You know, there's
in that All for Nothing, the Man City documentary. I started watching it there recently because I knew the Spurs one was coming out this week, and they had a brilliant kit man. I don't know, did you see it?
Yeah,
and he's just the heart and soul of the dressing room, and the players be singing songs, and he has that. But he knows his role. He knows his role, and I think it's very important that a manager, when he's choosing his selectors or his coaches, that he tells them exactly what he wants from them, and they know their role, that they're not overstepping the mark or they're not doing something that he doesn't want them to do. So I think that's very important when you get your management team together at the start of the year. Whenever you're going for a job or whatever it is, and you explain exactly what you want from them and what their role is.
And probably the most important thing for them, nearly above all else, is what Paul has said, is they have to feel confident to challenge you. They have to feel that they're in a position to challenge you.
Like you mentioned the kit man there, and like that's why I just think the film is so real to life. Like just the scenes where they go without the football and then probably what back off the kids, they're making a there's class within all sports. There's people who carry out that kit man role, logistics role, who 100% the operation could not function without them. I could list off three or four people now straight away who are top quality operators, and the operation they're involved in would not run without them, you know. And like, And then you go and you talk about the fella, the challenger, or is he just a selector? Like the role of Lonnie, like, I don't even know what his role is. Like, what is his role? A bit of comic relief every time the lads are coming into the car park.
Trying to sell them cars. What was he trying to sell them? Hondas.
Yeah, Hondas and Vauxhalls, whatever. Yeah. But he needed an assistant manager. That's why he was there. He was told he needed an assistant manager and a coach, and that's who he got, to Phyllis, that he knew and probably worked with before in a thing. Like back in the film then, like I thought one of the things that was very interesting was when he did the shirts and skins, essentially. Anyone born the first half of the year, go over that side, and anyone born the second half of the year, and that's it. And like, I don't know, is it actually meant, well, what we took out of it, I'd imagine, was relative age effect of that in development squads and underage, you would have very strong, and like, I know that there's lads probably on this podcast that are planning on trying to have kids born at the start of the year.
Christ.
Yeah, there we go, hands up. but it is, like, underage, it is something, like, no. I'm presuming they did it for comical effect in the film, because then he said second half of the month and first half of the month and they all went the other side. And I don't know, does that instill any research done on that? But it is something that's very important from an underage side, like the relative age effect, and like there's so much research done on it. And I know that was it 2 years ago involved with Tony Forrest still in Cork, Tony Forrest and Sonny Walsh, that of the 24 players on the Tony Forrest panel, which would be the A hurling.
Under 14.
Yeah, under 14, there was, I think, 21 of them were born the first half of the year. And on the B squad, I think there was 12 of them born the first half of the year. So even within a mini squad already of 48 players, you could see how they evolved. And like that's something, especially from sport. Like, is there any way of counteracting that? Or is there anything, like, would you be conscious that even when young fellas come in now, let's say, on the younger side into the senior squads and stuff?
Being aware of it.
Yeah.
Being aware that it is an actual fact. And then looking through dates of birth. Like, if you get that if you're dealing at under 13 level or under 12 level, like you're talking about a good 7-8% younger the fella born in December is to January. Now obviously that gets more, it gets less as years go on, but there's a huge amount of development that's there, that if you're not aware of it, you're just going to pick the best lad. But if you go, well, you know what, he's effectively a year younger than that fella, he has more scope for development long term, you know. So taking that in is important.
Yeah, look, the big voice on this in Ireland in soccer certainly is Laura Finnegan down in WIT. She does some absolutely fantastic research on it and some brilliant thought-provoking pieces, working onto her Twitter and reading some of the stuff that she's got on it. I was kind of in between roles. I had a weekly column with the Times, and one of the columns I did one of the weeks was on this. And what I did just after reading some of Laura's stuff, I went on to the League of Ireland and I had a look at the League of Ireland and had a look at the regular starting 11s of the 10 teams in the Premier Division. So you're talking about 10 teams by 11 players. So just over, say, 110 players kind of, and I suppose some of the teams that have the players would be coming in now. So there's maybe a sample size of about, I think it was about 120, 125 players I looked at as a sample size. It was just absolutely incredible. Five players from the 120 were born in the last quarter of the year. Like that, yes. I couldn't get over it. And I know, Mossy, before we came on, you had mentioned him, like within that five, say, was Lee Grace. And Lee Grace is a fantastic example of how a player can almost be missed based purely on their date of birth. Like Lee will tell you himself, so just to quantify, sorry, first, Lee Grace is currently with Shamrock Rovers. I would have had him at two of my League of Ireland clubs, both Wexford and Galway. He's an absolutely fantastic player. Very nearly got a move to England last year, and he's a guy that I genuinely believe could walk into an Irish international senior training session and be well up to the mark, no problem to him. But Lee never made a single Waterford representative underage squad the whole way up. Not one in soccer. Not one. I think he said for his first time ever selected was for an under 18 game. And even at that, that's because the under 19 League of Ireland had started. So all the so-called better players were gone to League of Ireland level. So the representative level now is not as strong. And like it was mad in terms of, just to give you the story on my side of it, believe it or not, as much knowledge as you tend to give out to him, a referee, I was managing Wexford and the referee after the game, the referee was from Waterford. And after the game, the referee came into me and he said, Shane, look, if you're looking out for players, he says, I was down at a junior game down in Waterford last weekend. He says, geez, there was a boy playing. And he says, I don't know now, but I thought he looked exceptional. So he gave me a name and the whole lot. And I went down to Waterford. Lee is from Tip, but his club, Carrick, were playing in the Waterford League. Went down and had a look at this boy who was like 22 years of age, never got a sniff of League of Ireland football or anything like that. He's in the army at the time and the whole lot. I mean, that's 4.5 years ago. And I mean, this boy is going to be marking Zlatan Ibrahimovic against AC Milan in 2 weeks' time, you know. And he could have been missed. He could have been missed because he was smaller than other people. Like he said, that's why he didn't get picked the whole way up along. He was smaller than everybody else, and he's still not the tallest for a centre half. Mm. But look, I get plenty of slagging around here because I'm a big believer in relative age effect, and then I have one child who, of course, is born in January. So that's
yeah. I think Paul is a January baby as well, and I won in February. That's grand. But well, I remember when I was playing. When I was playing football, soccer, when I was younger, and the date was the 1st of July or 1st of August at underage. It was 1st of August. And then when about under 13, it changed to back to January. And the difference you could see with guys who were starring at, say, under 13, because they're born in August, if you get me, and July. And then when they went back, it was mind blown. Like there were stars of the team, and now they're just barely making the team, if not making the team at all. And it just, like, it opened my eyes, and I think back and I said, yeah, the difference in age is just incredible between the start of the year and the end of the year.
So, and Colm, I mean, you were saying, Colm, what can be done to mm-hmm. alleviate it? I mean, mm-hmm. I'll tell you again a story that just shows it. I mean, I remember so Sean McGuire would be from my area, and I would have had Sean from the age of 10 till about 16. But at about at under 15 level, he'd got called into Irish trials again. He'd been into Irish trials a few times and never quite made the grade. And he'd got called into Irish trials again and no, hadn't made the final squad again. And he was now at a stage where he was like, he was at breaking point with it. And I honestly believe he was so close to kind of packing in any attempts to be a serious footballer. And the next thing, the FAI got word from Holland that they were having what they were calling a future developers tournament out there, where I don't think it was so much based on date of birth. I think it was more based on size. Yeah, size and weight. You had to be under a particular height or weight or body mass or something along those lines anyway. And sure, you know, Sean was 4 foot nothing at the time, so he was easily under it all. And he got selected in that. And that kind of, you know, I genuinely believe had that tournament not come up, he may very well have disappeared off the soccer landscape. And thankfully that did come up, and it was a brilliant initiative and it did come up, and it refocused him, and look, he's kicked on fantastically since then, you know.
Yeah, that's excellent.
Is Southampton do a lot in that as well, do they, in terms of
I've heard that, I think they do. And obviously the other one that you probably hear a good bit about is New Zealand rugby. I think New Zealand rugby is done completely on size and body mass, and they just completely ignore when you were born. They don't care when you were born. It's all done on size and body mass.
Yeah. No, as I said, just from a GA perspective, I'll obviously read up on what Laura has, but like I was just trying to think, is it something that, let's say, if we have an under-8 team, you know, once the player turns to 8, should we move them up a grade to the 9s so that everybody throughout the year will get a chance to be the oldest in an age group? But as I said, because the GA being the ultra-competitive world it is, and I know it's not too bad underage down the lower side, but everybody'd want to be doing it to see a benefit out of it, because if one club is doing it and all of a sudden they're getting hammered, then you got the negative side effects of that and stuff like that. But I don't know, it's just something that I was saying, Christ, you know, if we did that, would that sort out the thing that everybody is going to be the biggest player in the team and they're going to be the smallest player in the team over the given year, as opposed to the same fella born in January every year being the big boy? But I said, maybe
this dream in there now, I think.
That's right. See, I'm a romantic. Totally, I'm a romantic. All these lovely notions. But the other thing I found was, I thought was very funny in film, was the sports science aspect of it. When, I'd imagine back, like, I think, was it 1999 or 2001 when the film came out, that sports science was probably a new thing. No, I know it was probably done, but it was probably a new thing to the major... to everybody, let's say, to the public, as opposed to the East Germans and their drugs programs and the cyclists and whatnot. But
I will.
Yeah. no more East Germany, so all right. But like, I suppose it can be important as well that the proper use of sports science and the proper use of stats is very important, because like, I know we can get like the stats machines out there now that can throw back 100 different things for you every match, but like, are all of them that important, or are you using some of them detrimental than using others? So is that something that you've seen advanced over the last couple of years, or is it just being kind of solid now and we're at a plateau level?
Yeah, look, in League of Ireland soccer, there's been absolutely colossal advancements in it. I mean, when you think about it, really, it's amazing, particularly with me being involved in Dundalk at the moment, that we essentially have the world leader in GPS on our doorstep in stat sports. You know, it's colossal what them guys are doing. They're just absolutely phenomenal. They're the world power, really. So they are. And yeah, look, it's something I would have always been into. I'd be kind of a numbers geek anyway, so I would, you know, both in terms of GPS and in terms of actual stats. In the League of Ireland, again, it's a bit mad. So the league has a national deal with... Last year they used Instat. This year they've gone with Y-Scout. So basically the rule is that within 24 hours of the final whistle, every game that has been played will be up on a shared platform that everybody can access, fully coded, literally every touch of the ball fully coded. And everybody can see everybody else's games. Everybody has full access to everybody else's match reports, the whole lot. And you just have to back your manager and your department to make more use of what's available to them than any of the rest. So there's endless information. I mean, say, like, we played Cove yesterday, and I think I checked at half 11 and it wasn't up yet. I think by half 12 it was up, fully coded, every single touch of the ball. If I want to see the passes Brian Gartland played, I put in Brian, I take Brian Gartland, I take passes, and instantly I'll have a list of the 25, 30 passes that Brian Gartland made, and I can just watch a full playlist of every one of them. So look, it's an incredible resource that we've got. I know I'm in a WhatsApp group with all kind of the top performance analysts in the GEA at the moment. So I am, just because it's great to see what they're doing and to try and learn a few things from all of those. Brian McDonald set that up, and it's a fantastic resource. So it is. And I know, I think, you know, there's been a lot of talk amongst a lot of them could they create something similar at GEA level as to what we've got at League of Ireland in that sense, you know?
Is that a high cost for every club in the league, or is the FAI covering it, or what way does it work?
It's not, Mossy, would you believe? It's not, and I'll tell you why it's not, and I don't think I am getting anybody in trouble for this. So Instat and Y Scout, yeah, they do charge a fee, but it's amazing how low the fee is. But I've since learned why the fee is as low as it is. That's not their main revenue generator. Their main revenue generator is by agreeing to use our services, you are giving us ownership of your video footage. They're then selling the video footage onto the betting companies.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Companies are using that video footage to create all their odds and all their you know, to feed into all their systems. So they're actually not looking to make charge an arm and a leg. Their main thing is, can we have your video set up so that we can use your video to make revenue in other ways? So no, it's very manageable. I mean, last year it was just the Premier Division sides. This year it's all the First Division sides too. And I mean, all the First Division sides would have, you know, little to no money to play with.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
financially affordable for them as well. The thing, I suppose, the thing is with the column is there's so much information now, you know, that you have to be able to distill it down very quickly into, well, what is actually useful for you? What is actually useful for your team? I mean, to be honest with you, I probably did get overly wrapped up in it at times, and at times maybe the tail started to wag the dog. You know, I was kind of losing focus on the things that matter more, you know, the quality of a training session, you know, the quality of your relationship with players. I was maybe getting, you know, overly wrapped up in my performance analysis, in my stats, in my GPS, all that kind of stuff. Look, it can be a massive benefit to you, but you've got to remember at the end of the day, it's really only the 5%, you know. Jesus, don't have it take up time or headspace that you need to be dictated, that should be kind of aimed at more important stuff, if that makes sense.
There is a lack of understanding of how to utilise that information out there. People think, all right, oh, Dublin have this, or Tipperary have this, or Rovers have this, or Dundalk have that, and I want it. But if you don't know how to use it and make it affect results at the far end, there's no point in having it. Like, no, and it is. I think a lot of it has gone completely out of control, and it's down to people not knowing how to use a thing to the best of its ability.
Like. Yeah, what's the line? Not everything that can be counted counts.
Not everything that can be measured counts, and everything that counts can't be measured.
Who was the rugby player who came over into a huddle and he kept running just to get his GPS stats up?
Really? Yeah.
Yeah, it was one of the locks back.
Oh, look, I've made those errors before. You know, I've. You know, you'd look at two centre halves and you know, why is one centre half's GPS number is higher than the other? Well, because he goes up for corner kicks and the other fella doesn't, you know.
It's simple, yeah.
It'd be as simple as that at times, you know.
And, like, it's similarly enough, oh, geez, that fella's great at tackling. And, well, sure, that fella's never involved in anything. Mm. Like, the fella who isn't involved in anything is getting his positioning right before he has to do anything. So that off the ball activity that happens, until that's able to be reliably measured and quantified, it does, like, because the on ball actions are so infrequent. So it's the off ball stuff. What do you do that makes it easier for your team to score, or the harder for the other team to score?
The only reason anything should be counted, Paul, is that it's answering a question. There needs to be a question first. Is there a question that you're trying to answer with this information, or does it just look good on a spreadsheet?
Yeah. And Shane, like that information now that you're saying that you haven't, if you, like, I know that there's a bunch of the intercounty football analysts share videos with each other. So every match like that, every match, like, how does that affect you as a coach then, that, like, they know everything about you? Like, you have to be able to adapt and improve. Like, obviously the quality of coaching and play is obviously improving because of that overall, is it?
Yeah, it is. And look, you don't mind so long as it's a level playing field, I suppose. You know, you're just backing yourself to try and make more use of the information than the opposition. But there's no doubt that you need to be more, particularly around set pieces, Colm, I suppose. You know, like, you cannot roll out the same set pieces every week for a season, because not with all this video footage there for everybody to access now. Sure, we all know what each other are at, you know, and you'll find clubs will use something maybe for 2 weeks and then bin it, and then it might reappear again a month or two down the line and that kind of stuff. You really do need to be creative. But as I say, you don't mind so long as it's a level playing field. And look, it's not always a level playing field. We had a Champions League qualifier against Celje there 2 weeks ago, and the unfortunate problem that we had was that this wonderful new product that the League of Ireland have rolled out, Watch LOI, which is fantastic. You pay a small fee and you get every game streamed. Sure, obviously Celje were after buying one of these licenses and were able to watch all of our games, while at the same time they weren't actually playing games at all. So like, they would have seen what we were doing inside out, and we couldn't get as much access to them at all. And it's very similar now. We've drawn an Andorran club in the next round. We're playing on the 17th of September. And again, their league season isn't running at the moment. They're not back in their league season till October. So I've got to kind of scratch around for last season. And I suppose at least we will have the Champions League qualifier that they played 2 weeks ago to look at, and that, which can be sure these boys are going to be subscribing.
They have all their games.
And they were a new subscriber to Watch LOI this morning, you know, when that draw was made.
Yeah. Very good. And do you ever hold back, say, a set piece? Say, if you're playing, you're Dundalk, or I just throw it as top of the league, then you're playing a bottom table team, and you have a brilliant set piece. Like, would you ever hold it back, say, no, I'm going to use that for, against a higher standard team, if you get me?
Yep, 100%. I'd go as far as to admit, Mossy, I remember. Before all the video footage came in, before all the performance analysis, the platform, let's say, came in, when I would have been at Wexford, we were playing, similar to what you've just described, we were playing a team, we were challenging for the title at the time, it was the year we won it, and we were playing a team that were down around the bottom, and we had worked on a set piece, and 5 minutes before kickoff, I looked over my shoulder and saw the manager from the team we were about to play next week, who were challenging for the title with us, and it was, you know, out to the pitch and tell the boys, scrap that. we're not running that one this week, and hold on to it till next week. So yeah, he would have all that kind of crack going on as well.
Very good. We would have seen in the film as well that, like, the time they didn't have the football and they trained without the ball. And I know Paul spoke about it in last season's podcast, but Eamon O'Shea, about training without the ball just to give players, I suppose, an awareness of positioning and setup and stuff like that. Like, let's say, if a random punter arrived at your training session, what's the maddest thing like that you would have done?
I don't know what I've had too much harebrained stuff.
No, as I said, there's value to it. Like, obviously, like, Eamon O'Shea, Paul spoke about, like, and Eamon O'Shea did it, and there was value to what they were doing. But for, as I said, for someone looking in from the outside going, what in the name of God? Is there anything at all?
I, to be honest with you, I don't know. Look, I don't think anybody's on the same wavelength as Eamon O'Shea when it comes to being innovative in that sense. To be honest with you, it's there's no real reinventing the wheel. Personally, I feel myself with coaching. You know, it's very hard to come up with something new that they haven't seen before. To be honest with you, occasionally you might throw in something a bit mad, almost more for entertainment purposes and just to keep things lively and keep fellas, you know, a bit of crack around the place. Like, you know, you might have a five-a-side game of soccer, but you throw in a rugby ball instead of a soccer ball. But that's not for any major technical or tactical reason other than just to have a bit of crack with it. Look, the one that I found most interesting, without a doubt, was on my own podcast, was interviewing Niall Corcoran. And Niall spoke about the fact, now he was a bit reluctant to talk about it, but I dragged it out of him because one of the players had told me, but he brought in these eye patches. So apparently, I didn't know now, to be honest with you, but apparently the same way you have a dominant hand and a dominant leg, you've got a dominant eye.
Yeah.
And I would be massive into scanning and the art of scanning and how important scanning is in football. And it'd be something I'd be trying to hammer home in my training sessions, this idea of constantly knowing your surroundings and glancing over your shoulders when you're not on the ball and all that kind of thing. So when Niall brought this, or when I was told about this and got Niall to talk about it, he was saying, yeah, so basically one of your eyes scans far better than the other eye and takes in far more information than the other eye. And it was amazing. I'd never thought of it like that. So the idea was that he brought in these eye patches and the boys wore them in training sessions and they wore them over their dominant eye. The idea being that if you don't have the dominant eye, the other one has to do more. The same way you might tell a fella, you know, I've had soccer training sessions, maybe not at adult level, but at kids level, I've had soccer training sessions where, you know, with an 8-year-old, 9-year-old who mightn't even know he's right from his left yet, you tell them to wear a green sock and a red sock, you know, and today they're only allowed to kick with the red sock. It's the same as trying to improve the non-dominant leg. You can, and I think there's research out there, you can improve the non-dominant eye. And to me, that's a bit mad. And some people might think mentally, you know, and a bit ridiculous. I think it's brilliant. I think stuff like that is absolutely brilliant. I thought that made a lot of sense.
I'd say that probably came from the skill acquisition, because I know Ed Collin was with Dublin Senior Hurlers, and like, I know Keane O'Neill was on, I don't know, was it on the news or what? Was on Keane O'Neill had Kildare footballers with the ocular vision things.
Glasses,
and
yeah.
I think, yeah, and I think a lot of that probably came from Ed Collin when he was with Dublin.
You're right, yeah. Yeah, no. Niall mentioned Ed in it, so he did. And I had read a piece before. The only mention I'd seen of it before, I didn't know Keane had done it. The only mention I'd ever seen of it before was Donny Buckley. I think Donny had done something along those lines with, at some stage as well, yeah.
Was he with Mayo at the same time, Massey, as Ed Collin?
And they're doing the toothbrush with their weaker hand.
Yeah, it was Donny Buckley with
them. Used to get them at night time to wash their teeth with their
the opposite hand.
With their opposite hand.
Yeah, just all little things like that.
Like talking about that and then being able to apply it properly. Simon Cooper has a book called Football Against the Enemy. And it talked about the USSR team in the 1988 Euros. And the team, obviously it was after the fall of Russia or the USSR properly. I don't specifically know the politics of it, but it was loads of different countries. And they used a load of specific testing, like scanning testing, computer-based testing, to pick the squad. So they picked the squad, nothing to do with football, purely based on numbers, facts, figures. They didn't win it, obviously.
CIS 92, I think. There was just when you're getting back there about mad things at trainings. Remember, was it Brian Kerr or Jack Charlton? They're in the stadium the night before a training session and the spies are out. So what did they do when the spies came? They started playing Gaelic football. Just to confuse them all together.
It was probably
one way to throw him off the scent, all right.
Absolutely, yeah.
Just hope it wasn't Egypt in 1990. And it might explain a lot. Very good.
That's back to film. Egypt and England are pretty boring, and Mike Bassett here as well, wasn't it? That
was there was the a nil all draw, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And the other thing that, like, just from the film again, like, and I just like the way that being in charge affected his home life, like, obviously. Like, as sports coaches and interested in sports, there's an awful lot of potential distractions to get out of the house or get into the other room and stuff like that. How do you balance that?
Yeah, well, I suppose probably the first thing I'd say on the column is I do think it's often the elephant in the room. You see so many interviews with managers and so many autobiographies with managers, and no, it's very rare that any of them actually talk about that. It's very, very rare that any of them talk about, you know, any effect on home life. Like, the rate, have you ever seen the rate of divorce in professional football managers? It's absolutely ridiculous, honestly. It's colossal. It's insane.
Yeah, but a bit of that is just moving on to a better looking model the next.
you've been keeping an eye on Brendan Rodgers, I think, Paul. Have you? No, look, in all seriousness, it's a major challenge. It really is a major challenge. And I suppose if I was to pinpoint two occasions kind of in my managerial career to date that would kind of sum it up. Like, in 2015, like, from a football point of view or from a career point of view, 2015 should be the highlight of my sporting career. Like, with Wexford Utes that season, we started that season at 40-1. And we had the League of Ireland First Division Championship wrapped up with three games to go. So it was absolutely superb what we did that year, okay? But behind that, the bit that people don't see is, so we'd had Connor, so just to give you a count, so I've got one son, he's five or five and a half, as he'll tell you, the half is very important when you're five and a half. And Connor was born in January in 2015. Now, my work-lifestyle balance was pretty much non-existent at that time, because what I was doing was I was living in Laois, living in Rathdowney in Laois. I was the manager of the Leinster Leader newspaper in Kildare, and I was managing Wexford Utes. So 3 to 4 days a week, my routine was get up in the morning, head up, drive from Rathdowney up to Naas, about an hour's drive, work from 9 till 5, get into the car, drive from Naas down to Wexford, about an hour and 45, do a training session, maybe team meetings after the whole lot, leave Wexford somewhere between 10 and half past 10, and get back to Laois after another hour and 45 minute drive, sometime around half 12-ish, maybe thereabouts, half 12, between half 12 and 1 o'clock. That's just about doable when you're a young single man. It becomes more difficult when you're young and married, but becomes nigh on possible when you're young, married, and have a child. And it was really, really, really difficult. It was really, really difficult. And there's no other way to describe it, really. I did feel kind of over the course of that year like an absentee father. I really, really did. I wasn't around as much as I should have been. I absolutely wasn't. And I remember kind of as it was coming up to it and it looked inevitable, I think we only needed 3 points from the last 4 games. And myself and Mick Wallace was the chairman down at Wexford, and you know, different people would have different opinions of Mick. I honestly could not say a bad word about him. He was absolutely fantastic for me. He was phenomenal for me. And we sat down, and I just had to say to him, I says, Mick, if we pull this off and we go up, I says, this is completely unsustainable. I says, you're going to have to make me full time, or I'm going to have to pack it in, because I can't ever have another year like that. I can't. It's not fair to anybody for me. And thankfully, yeah, Mick completely understood where I was coming from. And he did give me a chance to go full time, which I'll always be thankful for him of. But, you know, when that final whistle went, it was more relief at the season being over and an opportunity to have some proper family time at home almost than anything else was nearly the overriding feeling. But as yeah, I say, it's kind of, you know, I think there's a lot of people in a very, very similar boat. So it's just not really talked about a whole lot, you know?
It's true. And what about when you do get your downtime at home? Like say you're coming in from a training session and you get home, what sort of things you do to like relieve your stress or your downtime, basically to get away from it, your escapism? Like, I think it's very important for all coaches to have that you're not taking home a training session with you.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, look, the escapism now obviously is Connor, because, you know, as soon as I walk in that door, he's you know, he's running over and he wants to tell you all about his day and the good things and the bad things that happened and all that. And that is wonderful. And it really, really is wonderful. And I'll tell you when that was hugely important as well, Mossy, was when I was going through the rough time at Galway. Because, you know, pretty much when you're going through a run of bad results as a manager, everybody's aware of them, and you know, everybody brings it up in conversation and mentions it, and it's almost impossible to have a conversation with anybody without it raising its head. Connor doesn't mention it. He was four. He doesn't know whether dad's winning or losing or anything like that. And he's probably the one person in the world that has no interest in the fact that results are going bad for you. And to be able to, you know, if we lost the game on a Friday night, you know, you'd come home, you'd be in bad form. He comes in and he jumps on top of you at 6:30 on the following morning, and he wants you to go up and play with him, and he wants to head to the park. It's the best distraction you could ever have. It's the best distraction you could ever possibly have. It really, really is. So I don't know what outlets people who don't have kids.
So you're suggesting that all coaches just have a baby?
Just make sure they're born in January.
Yeah.
No, I'd echo what Shane said there. Like, it is, while you might be missing a lot from time to time when you do come home, it is an environment where, be it football or hurling or whatever it is the least important thing then in the world. Whereas it is for a lot of the day and a lot of time is the only thing you possibly think about and obsess about too much. It is great to come home and to be in an environment where couldn't care less that your daddy effectively And I think that the whole, one of the real benefits of COVID-19 is the fact that people who have been nonstop in any aspect of their life have got an opportunity to slow down and spend time with family, you know? So
100%.
Cherished.
And I think it does, like, I think we're all very lucky with the respective others, very understanding respective others we all have. But like for a lot of players and a lot of people, coaches as well, like it'll come a time when you actually have to check yourself and be conscious of what you're missing out on versus what you're giving to a group of players or whatever. So, and like, I know that from a county perspective during COVID with the inter-county players, and there was players talking about losing their identity and stuff like that. And that's not really a good place for them psychologically if that's their identity as being an inter-county player. So it is important that there is, I suppose, reflection on what matters more than anything. It's like everything is important, but some things do take greater importance.
It's a lot easier though when you're winning all the time to do these things, to have your downtime. But when you're losing, like, you probably bring more pressure on yourself to what am I doing wrong, and you're thinking about it more and whatever it is. So I think it's when you are in a situation where things aren't going too well that you do still have something to get away, that you can forget about things, and then you're more fresher the next morning or the next day when you have to go back at it again.
Yeah, Roisin would have said, my wife Roisin would have said to me, she would have praised how good I was at still being in good form on a Saturday for Connor, even if we'd lost on a Friday. But at the same time, she would always say that there's a very obvious difference between fake happy daddy and real happy daddy. She would say, you know, I if we'd won on a Friday night, I was a much more enjoyable person to be around on a Saturday, even though I would be making my best effort on a Saturday, even if we lost, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and I can't remember who said it, but it was something I read back a couple of months ago, and they said, win or lose, you should do the same thing that night. That, you know, like, if we win the county final, we're going to go out and celebrate, and we'll get 2 or 3 days out of it. Whereas if we lose, some fellas mightn't turn up for the celebration or for the commiserations. And, you know, the team, I suppose, like, once you're doing your best and trying to be as good as you can be, you know, some things are just beyond their control, like, and it's important to have perspective in that regard, like.
But they said, don't get too high with your wins and don't get too low with your lows.
Yeah. It's a lot of lows, Thomas.
I know.
Anything else on the film? What was your favourite scene in the film? Or favourite part of the film?
Well, my favourite line of the film was, he was like a father to me. Like a father figure to me. My dad was like a father figure
to me. Yeah, I got down as well. Paul?
There was one really good one liner where the fan in the wheelchair goes, "We're gonna walk it." But my favorite scene was the stereotype scene in the hotel between the Irish, the English, and the Scots.
Yeah, that was very funny.
Yeah, I don't know if it's so much just that it was the finale to it or that makes it stick with me so much, but I just thought it was hilarious how adamant he is in that interview on the flight on the way back that, you know, that's it. He's done and dusted. Yeah. And I think Manny's a coach and Manny's a manager, probably has been there, that, you know, this is it. This is the last year now. We're not going beyond this. And the next thing, when the adulation arrives, it's 4 more years. Where's the contract? Yeah.
Or even when you have a week's break and you say, that's it, and done. And then you have a week's break and you're missing it. And you're just mad to get back at it then again.
I two scenes that I really liked. One was when, and I actually wrote it down, like, so I would have seen it probably 20 years ago. But it was when he was getting the feedback from the lads, from the fans outside the bus. And it was all really good stuff. Like, and I was like, eureka moment, takes on board feedback. And then I scratched it out. And then, go fuck yourselves. I thought that was brilliant. And the other bit was when, what was your man? The striker, the drunk fella. Can't think of his name. When the tranny came out of the room, he was like, and he came back from something. He was like to Bassett. He was like, I've never seen that fella in my life. it was just a very good film. It's a lot of stereotypes, but it was enjoyable to watch. Like, and did you know, as I said, there was an awful lot of coaching points. Positive, like, there was, in fairness, there was more negatives than positives, but they're talking points, and for us to even have a chance to chat about it, I think is important. So any last thoughts on it?
No, I love the way as well when he talked about, you know, you talk about the sandwich of giving negatives and positives. He talks about giving the honest points and then the negatives, you know, like that. It was the honest points were the negatives, you know, that kind of way. Yeah. The way he framed it was good.
I know, it's good. Now, just one quick thing there about there was a part there when he lost all his players with the sports science. And some key players, and you need to bring up fellas from second and third division stuff. I know when you were at Gall United, go back to Lee Grace there, he was a key player, but you had to sell him just financial reasons. And I think even it's Gall United paying for that now. If you're able to keep hold on to him for that, whether it's $20,000, whatever it was, if you're able to keep hold on now, I think the club being in a lot better position it was. But how do you cope with losing such a key player to injury, to whether they're quitting, going to do a new club or something like that? Something that's...
Yeah, well, if I'm perfectly honest about Mossy, I probably didn't cope very well in that scenario. I mean, I gave 3 hours in a hotel, you know, the night before deadline day, trying to talk to two members of the board of directors out of it, because he was that good for us. I knew it was probably going to be the difference between staying up and not staying up. But even aside from that, like, I'd been with Lee probably, you know, three and a half, four years at that stage. I had an incredible emotional connection with him. And, you know, it was, Jesus, you know, sitting down to say good luck to him. And, you know, part of it is killing you that you're losing him. And the other part of you wants to wish him the very best, because you do see huge potential and you can see him going all the way to the top. And even the logistics of it must be mad. Like, because we'd signed... we were signing a guy, Rory Hale, who did fantastic
for me.
Up in the Irish League with Crusaders now. But like, I'm driving back from the airport with Rory Hale, having picked him up. I'm on the phone to Stephen Hunt. It was an awkward situation as well, because Stephen Hunt was my agent, in so much as he had negotiated my contract at Galway for me. He was Lee Grace's agent. So this conversation was going on all day, because it was really right down to the last minute as to whether the deal was going to go through or not. And as it transpired, we had some houses rented in Galway for players who weren't living locally. So I'm literally walking into the house with Rory Hale as Lee Grace is walking out, and you're leading Rory Hale into Lee Grace's bedroom, telling him this is now your bedroom, like, kind of a thing. You know, it's a mad world. But you kind of, I probably learned a few lessons there, in that I probably did harp on his loss for a little bit too long, and that probably had maybe a little bit of a negative impact on the dressing room. I think from now on, even if you are feeling it either emotionally or just in terms of the quality of the player, I think you need to put a brave face on it a bit quicker than I did and brush it under the carpet and just talk about the quality that you've still got, you know.
Just move on.
Very good.
That's
very
it.
Good. Very good.
Perfect. Stuff. Anything else, Ted?
I think there's probably plenty of Mike Bassett's spot in soccer and in hurling and in Gaelic football that are still managing to land gig after gig, isn't there? So it's just, you know, while it might be taken to a very silly level in the movie, it's not completely unrealistic either.
Yeah, no, it's definitely worth watching, to be honest with you.
Perfect.
Thank you, Shane.
Thanks very much for the time coming on with us. And
no problem.
Go on, give a plug there to the podcast.
Yeah, look, absolutely. How to Win at Domino's is the name, I suppose, first and foremost. It is through the 42.ie. They have a membership scheme that they've got loads of fantastic content on it, podcast-wise, some brilliant ones. Gavin Cooney's got a brilliant podcast where he sits down with a different sports journalist every week. That's one of my mainstays of my podcast listening every week, is another fantastic one. And an absolutely fantastic documentary that they've rolled out over the last two months on Stephen Kenny. I think it's 8 parts in total, and again, it's Kevin Brannigan, who did the Kerr's Kids documentary, is behind that. So look, there's loads of brilliant stuff aside from my own wonderful podcast, obviously, on there. So there is
excellent.
Very good.
That's great. Thank you, Shane. Very much.
Thanks a million. Really enjoyable.
Thanks for joining us today. Please leave a review on your favorite platform, and if you enjoyed it, tell a friend. You may also want to follow us on Twitter at Roy Orbison Tattoo, and we appreciate any likes, retweets, and comments. Next week, we will be watching Remember the Titans, and we'll have the show available first thing Tuesday morning, as always.